Knock, knock, guess who is knocking at your door? That's right, you know it's the morning for sure. Might be a GRF, it could be. Maybe it's Mitt Romney. Know you love this week in Mormons, original Mormon news. If you love Lindsey Sterling, Bryce Harper in Utah, and Jell-O salad foods, oh, you're gonna love this show.
Hey, everybody, stinkers! It's not leading LDS this week. Well, yeah, but see, I get so excited. This is this weekend. This is This Week in Mormons this time. This Week in Mormons. I'm Jeff. We're happy to be here. This is your Mormon news podcast, and we're jazzed for all that we're doing. Before we get to the meat of the show today, I'd like to take this opportunity to encourage you to be a patron of TWIM on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thisweekinmormons. What is it? It's basically Kickstarter, but for recurring things. So if you love TWIM, it's essentially a way to subscribe through a monthly donation to help us pay our server fees, hosting fees for podcasts, things along those lines. You can do it. You can help. We'd really appreciate it if you did. So please go over to patreon.com, look for This Week in Mormons, just $1 a month. Something as simple as that can make a huge difference in helping us continue to give you TWIM. And now, without further ado, I want to welcome my co-host for today. You know him. You've heard him before if you listen to Sunday School Bonanza, our gospel doctrine podcast, and random episodes of This Week in Mormons. Kurt Frankum from Leading LDS is with us.
It's good to be here, Jeff. We're doing simulcast. I'm excited.
Yeah. How you been, dude? What's new?
Oh, man. Just preaching the word of leadership to the good old lay leaders out there that might be struggling, looking for some answers, and we're trying to provide them. So.
That's what you do. And you can do that at leadinglds.org, everyone.
That's right.
That's where you can
subscribe.
Find out. Kurt does podcasts, a lot of good resources, and a very active Facebook community as well. Definitely worth looking into. It's a good time. Well, this week with Kurt here, we're doing something different. It's we're not doing like news rundown like we often do. It's an interview week. I like interview weeks. They're fun. Sometimes they're very engaging. Sometimes they're terrible. You've heard this show in the past. And you know which ones are terrible. Hint, it usually involves movie producers. But other than that, we often have terrific guests. And we appreciate each and every one of them. And I'm excited for this interview this week. It's with John Berger, who's not a Mormon himself, but he's the author of Datanomics, How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. And what we learn from this book, and he deals, by the way, in particular with college-educated men and women, he deals with how essentially the gender gap, meaning the disparity between men and women, the ratio of men and women in different metropolitan areas in the United States, in his case, how that affects the dating scene. And it just so happens when I was reading this book, and it was very interesting across the board in any normal context, a little over halfway through, you stumble upon a chapter called Mormons and Jews. And I said, oh, my appetite has been whetted. Interesting. Let us learn more about how this affects Mormons and Jews. And it's a really engaging chapter, and if anyone's ever lived in Utah, a lot of the data comes from Utah because that's where the demographics are most pronounced. You can kind of nod your head and say, So it's a fascinating book.
It is. It's a great one.
Yeah.
It's that chapter.
Did you not read it, Kurt?
I didn't. I just skipped to that chapter.
I'm about to bring this guy on my show, and I've read his entire book cover to cover out of respect.
Hey, I'm a busy man. You know, I do.
John's a busy man too. He managed to write a whole book.
He did. And I have to manage to do podcasts.
What the problem is here. Anyway, so we're excited to bring him on. It's nice of him to take the time. So, Kurt, if you're ready, let's call him up here. Let's get him on the
show. Let's
do it. All right, let's bring on John Berger.
Hey, I'm good. Good. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, we're excited. It's always fun when the best way to flatter a Mormon is for a non-Mormon to investigate their life and learn more about them. And that is what you've done in your book.
We're such an insular people that it validates us when the outside world takes interest. It's very exciting.
Ain't that the truth? So.
I think that's a compliment.
It is.
Yeah. I'm going to take it as one. So,
that's my way of saying thank you for helping us figure out what on earth is going on in our religion. But you're the author of Datanomics. Maybe just give us some background of who you are and what led to a life of writing about dating.
Sure. So in my day job, I'm a writer for Fortune magazine. I write about much more boring stuff like the stock market, oil and gas, things like that. So the first question I typically get is basically, how the heck did a Fortune magazine writer end up doing a book on dating? And the really short answer is I just knew way too many single women in their 30s and 40s who had everything going for them dating-wise and were having no luck whatsoever. Yet all my single male friends, even ones who are barely mildly appealing, they never seem to stay single for more than 5 minutes. So but basically the goal of the book was to figure out why dating seems so much harder for women, particularly college-educated women, than for men.
Nice. And so does any of this come from your dating experience? Are you currently married? Or?
Yeah, I've been married for 20-plus years, so no, okay. It's not really related to my dating experience. Although I will say, my wife and I, when we were younger, we did try to play matchmaker with some of our single friends, mm-hmm. but yeah, I'm in my mid-40s, probably late-40s at this point. And yeah, I think once we hit like early-30s, I didn't know any single men anymore, but we knew all of these fabulous single women, and I couldn't figure out why that was. I think initially I just thought it had something to do with our unique circle of friends, but over time it just became clear to me that there was something weird going on where women were staying single and men weren't.
What's the general premise of the book?
So the focus of the book has nothing to do with religion, per se. The book looks at the demographics of college education. So for the past 15 years in the U.S., we've had 4 women graduate for every 3 men. So as a result, in the post-college dating pool, so to speak, we now have 1/3 more women than men. If you look at the census data for the U.S., there's about 5.5 million college grad women aged 22 to 29 versus about 4 million college grad men in that same 22 to 29 age bracket. So the core argument of my book is that it's this college gender gap, so to speak, that is responsible for the declining marriage rates for educated women and also for the rise of the hookup culture. There's actually a ton of social science that's been done on sex ratios, and it indicates that when men are in oversupply, the culture is more monogamous. When women are in oversupply, the culture is less monogamous. So that's the gist of it.
And that was really interesting. So when I came across this book, and when we'll get to the Mormon stuff, that was the other thing that jumped out when all of a sudden I hit a chapter called Mormons and Jews, and I said, oh,
yes.
Really? Really exciting. Yes. Okay. Yeah, it's an amazing argument. And I love the data that we see in the book that supports that you basically see scarcity rules at play, essentially, that when the men feel like they, and correct me if I'm saying this inappropriately, but that if the men basically have fewer pickings, they fight harder to get the girl because she yep. could be taken by another guy. Whereas on the flip side, of course, when men are left to their own devices and have, you know, the pick of the field, they are less inclined to, as you said, you know, be monogamous, and they just like to goof around or hook up culture.
Yeah, I mean, that is basically my argument, although I wouldn't leave the women out of the formula entirely. I mean, I do think when men are in oversupply, women become pickier, and when men are scarce, I believe women also buy into kind of a looser dating culture. So yeah, I don't believe everything is driven by the men. I believe women sure. have a role in this as well.
Well, basically, how does that work into Mormons and Jews then? How is it different? And what made you find a whole section on Mormons and Jews in a book that, by and large, deals with the stuff we just talked about, but then yeah, a whole chapter focused on those?
Right. So the bulk of the book deals with the secular world, not religion. But the reason I ended up looking at religious groups is because as I was researching the book, reporting the book, and also just talking about the book with friends and colleagues, I would have people tell me, well, yeah, that sex ratio stuff is interesting, but couldn't it just be that times have changed? Couldn't it just be that, you know, that sitcoms are a little raunchier these days than they used to be, or, you know, those rap videos on MTV, they're kind of polluting the minds of young people, et cetera, et cetera. So there was this argument that I needed to push back against, that the reason the dating culture, the mating culture had become less monogamous and a little more libertine, that I had to push back against this argument that this was entirely a response to the culture. But the other thing that bugged me about this argument is that I don't believe times change for no reason. And I mean, obviously the media, the movies, the music lyrics. I mean, I'm a big AC/DC fan, and I'm not sure that, you know, AC/DC's lyrics in the 1970s were any better than, you know, Snoop Dogg's lyrics today. I don't buy this idea that things are radically different now than they were, you know, when I was younger. So this is a long-winded way of saying that one of the ways that I wanted to sort of make my point is by looking at groups that I thought were less susceptible to outside cultural influences. And I began kind of searching for conservative religious groups where there were also sex ratio imbalances, and those sex ratio imbalances were playing out in exactly the ways I would predict based on the social science research that's been done on human behavior.
And John, I think it's important that as you go through this, point out that a lot of people maybe within the Jewish faith or the Mormon faith could make the assumption, oh, this is only a Mormon problem, right? That the rest of the world, they don't value marriage enough, so they're not trying to get married anyways, right? And that's just not the
case. No, yeah, no, absolutely not. And I will say, you know, one of the more interesting responses I had to the Mormons and Jews chapter is that I had born-again Christians and Muslims tell me that what they read in that chapter rang true to their own experiences. So I feel like there's something going on here with lots of religious groups this isn't unique to Mormons or ultra-Orthodox Jews. In general, and we can talk about the details a little more, but in general, men are more likely to fall away from organized religion than women are, and as a result, tend to have kind of a sex ratio imbalance among very religious people.
So that said, was there any particular reason to focus in on Mormons as opposed to evangelical Christians or Catholics or any other group? Would the Mormons support the data better, or just kind of happen that way?
Yeah, it was kind of happenstance. I was doing a fair amount of research both online and in the library looking for studies on research on sex ratios in various religious communities. And one of the first, or actually the first study I came upon was done, I think it was from Trinity College in Connecticut. And it looked at sex ratios within the Mormon community. And actually, the reason I ended up adding a section on Orthodox Jews is that a friend of a friend actually called me about a job, and I was already working on the book, and I couldn't interview for that job at the time, but he asked me what I was working on, and I told him on a lark I just happened to be working on this chapter, on the religion chapter, and I told him about the Mormon marriage crisis. And he kind of paused and said, that sounds a lot like the Shidduch crisis. He's an Orthodox Jew. So that's what led me to kind of pair Mormon dating and marriage with Orthodox Jewish dating and marriage.
So the Jews actually have a name for their crisis, the Shidduch crisis.
It's the Shidduch crisis. And I guess I should make it clear that Orthodox Jews are a minority within the Jewish American population. So, I mean, I'm Jewish, but I had never heard of the Shidduch crisis before I began working on this book. So they are kind of Orthodox Jews probably comprise 10-15% of the overall U.S. Jewish population. Just putting that out there.
Are the rest Reform?
Is it Reform or Conservative? Yeah, I would say the majority are Reform. There's kind of a middle group called conservative Judaism, but that's actually it's a shrinking population within American Judaism. the fastest growing groups are both the Orthodox in one end and the Reformed Jews on the other.
So, John, as you started, you know, diving into research studies about, you know, specifically around Jews and Mormons, and you referenced the IRIS study. I don't know if that's how you – the ARIS study. What started to jump off the page to you thinking, oh, this is it. This is proof that it's happening here.
Well, that study referenced the fact that among Mormons in Utah, and then actually the numbers are less lopsided outside of Utah. We can talk about that if you want, but at least within Utah, there's this 60-40 ratio of women to men within the LDS community. And based on all the kind of the secular research, the social science I had read, you know, the scholarship that's been done on how sex ratios affect behavior, I figured that this 60-40 ratio had to be kind of wreaking havoc in the Mormon marriage market. So I called up a journalist friend of mine who grew up in Utah and went to BYU, and I asked her about this, and she said, "Oh yeah, it's awful that she has all these fabulous, you know, girlfriends who can't find a guy," and she had all these stories. And it, as a New Yorker, like the idea of a Mormon marriage crisis sounds
absurd.
It sounds absurd because from my perspective, all you guys do is get married, right?
Yeah, right.
And in our history, multiple times, you know.
Right. Well, I wasn't going there. But yeah, I had no idea. I mean, it was on the one hand, I knew that kind of a lopsided sex ratio had to be having that effect, but to hear her tell me that, I was still a bit surprised, because I think outside of Utah, the rest of the nation's conception of the LDS Church is just marriage is held so highly, correctly. I mean, it's for both men and women. It's kind of, it's the goal, and that's probably an understatement, right? And so the idea that young people would be delaying marriage and women would be struggling to find people to marry, that surprised me. Although it surprised me, but it made sense based on the scholarship on sex ratios.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting with especially with men delaying marriage, and I wonder if there's some truth to this. I see, like in the rest of the book, for example, it does seem that in the sense of delaying marriage, this might be speaking generally, but that it's more of it's men pursuing hookup culture, sowing their wild oats, what have you, not just essentially saying they don't want to settle down yet. Whereas I feel like in Mormon culture, it's more that the men have an objective to settle down, but having the abundance of women in front of them with the lopsided ratio means they just become super picky in their quest to do so. Do you think that's a fair way to say that?
Yeah, I think it is, but although my guess is, or my certain, you know, having interviewed lots of secular singles around the country, I think that the guys would say they're having fun while they wait to find, you know, their special someone. So I don't think, you know, well, I mean, yeah, certainly there are guys out there who are just messing around, but
NICMO is what we call it.
What was it?
There's a term Mormons use called NICMO. It means non-committal makeout. It's very popular in Utah.
Okay. But there's kind of a, like, I'm not sure how much of this is pre-planned or conscious. I mean, I kind of feel like when the environment is such that men are in oversupply, or women are in oversupply, on the other hand, just the norms change. And I'm not sure that guys are doing a head count and saying, oh, well, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 of us and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. I'm going to now behave differently because there's more women than there are men. I kind of feel like it's more of a when in Rome phenomenon, that everybody kind of buys into a looser dating culture, so to speak, when women are overly plentiful.
And John, why would you say, I mean, you talk about this in the book as far as why is there, you know, 150 women to 100 men in Utah, or just in the church in general? Why is there this lopsided pattern?
So, as I said before, in all religions, women tend to be more devout, and men are more likely to leave organized religion than women. Now, my sense is, or based on the research out there, this pattern has been exaggerated in the LDS community, or at least particularly in the Utah LDS community, perhaps because of the Mormon mission. You can correct me if you disagree, but my sense is that over the past 30, 40 years, the importance for men of going on mission has increased. Is that fair to say?
Definitely since the 1970s, but
yes.
But I would also say that probably even since you published the book, though, only in the past 2 years, we've worked on amending the narrative so that those that don't serve for whatever reason are not social pariahs, essentially, which is what they've been in the past, sure.
Right, which is exactly what they've been in the past. And I think what's happened is, I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but I think isn't it less than half of men, Mormon men, go on missions? Is that still accurate?
It's about, I think, 30-40%, right, Kurt?
Yeah, that's what
do
I
do or don't.
Do go.
So it's less than half go on missions. For the guys who don't go on missions, if they feel a bit outsider-ish, so to speak, and they're not feeling as valued, I feel like those men are more likely to fall away from organized religion, or in this case, fall away from the LDS church because, of that, what you referenced, the pariah status. And the problem is that the age at which men are most likely to fall away from organized religion is in their late teens and 20s. And that's exactly the age when this kind of demarcation occurs between being an RM or being a non-RM.
Right. Yeah, and so basically we have, within our culture, there's some characteristics, whether we meant for this to be or not, but there's a certain level of status that will aid you in getting married, which is the RM status, right? Because everybody, generally people are looking for that status because it relates to faithfulness and commitment, those things. And so some of those elements of our culture maybe lend for this lopsidedness to happen.
Right. Although one thing I mentioned in the book, and perhaps you can fill me in on what's happened more recently, is that by moving up the mission age, it seemed like more men, and maybe more women too, were choosing to go on mission because there wasn't the situation where they were going to work for a year or going to school for a year and then being asked to like take a break from work or school to go on a mission. So it's more of a natural progression right from high school to a mission. And perhaps that has increased the number of particularly men who go on mission. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm not privy to any of the actual stats or anything, but we did see what we kind of referred to as a surge when they first dropped the age to 18 as the minimum age back in 2012 is when that happened. But I think Kurt and I both agree with this, that of course, aside from like more missionaries, I think it was a big play to help those young men stay active, because I believe if men go on missions, they are more likely to remain faithful in the church from then on out. So, because like you said, those years are delicate years, and there were probably a lot of kids that between the year of high school and then the age of 19 before would drift away. And so it's a good way to keep them in the faith. And then I would assume ideally if you keep them in the faith after their mission, that also can help aid the gender imbalance a little
bit
more.
Right. And just to be clear, I have no beef with the mission as a concept. And if Mormon missions happen at retirement age, like you hit 65, then you do a 3-year mission, this would all be moot because people don't leave organized religion at age 65. They leave organized religion at age 20. So this is not about faith or beliefs or practices. This is just kind of a quirk of demographics.
I'm sort of representing the leadership component of the audience here, and I'm just thinking of those young single adult ward bishoprics who, you mentioned outside of the church in the more secular world, people make the assumption that, the reason why marriage isn't happening is because the morals are just decreasing, the values, right? And there's more guilt in media and those things, and people are generally, sowing their oats, as Jeff said. But in the church, we make the assumption, these millennials, they're lazy. They don't get it. But you would maybe say that's not the
bunch
case.
Of snowflakes, bunch of snowflakes.
Because
a bunch of snowflakes. Yeah,
you're making the argument that it's a demographic issue, but for a lot of leaders, that seems like that answer is too easy. Like, it's not the demographics. it's because they're lazy and they don't get it. They don't know how to date.
Well, yeah, and for if I can interject,
they're bad at dating, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is actually something that we hear about a lot of the time. We've received counsel over the past many years to dissuading men from just hanging out, encouraging them to date women legitimately, not to sort of fall into a relationship. And I think there is sort of this portrait of a bunch of like goofy layabouts that the men aren't doing anything. But like Kurt said, I really wonder if it's just the sheer demographics just fueling this.
There's a like in the secular world, there's a book by an Atlantic writer named Hannah Rosen called The End of Men. And in The End of Men, Rosen refers to these guys as happy couch potatoes, which is a line I've borrowed several times when I've been on lecture circuit.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is this idea out there that particularly with the guys that I think you called them layabouts, or that they're lazy or they don't know what's good for them. And this doesn't just apply to dating. I think there's this belief out there that millennial men in particular professionally are kind of not motivated either. And I guess when I need to kind of push back against this idea,
yeah,
that I always point to is Silicon Valley. So mm-hmm. Silicon Valley geographically is pretty close. You know, Santa Clara County, California is a pretty good geographic proxy for Silicon Valley. And as you could probably guess, given that that's where the tech industry is based, Silicon Valley and Santa Clara County is basically the one part of the country where the demographics among young college grads are reversed. In other words, there are more college grad men than there are college grad women. And in terms of dating and marriage, this plays out exactly the way I would have predicted. If you look at the census data for Santa Clara County, California, the marriage rate for college-educated women is through the roof high, and the divorce rate for those women is through the floor low, which shows that when men are in oversupply, the whole culture is more monogamous. People marry more frequently, and they divorce less frequently. And the irony is that, like, you know, all these apps like Tinder, they were invented in Silicon Valley, and yet Tinder doesn't seem to be destroying the marriage culture in San Jose or in Santa Clara County.
There's got to be some truth to that, actually. I live in D.C., and I think it's more lopsided women to men, if I remember my single
it
days
is.
Here.
Yes, it is.
Even with among Mormons. But a lot of people, their next stop when they kind of get done with D.C. is they're all going to the Bay Area. And I don't think it's been a marriage mill necessarily, but I've definitely seen that's become a big, even in the Mormon community, that's become a big allure.
I mean, in the secular world, I've met so many women who went to places like like San Jose, California, that they have been struggling with dating in D.C. or Boston or New York. They moved to the Bay Area, and basically they were engaged within a year because there are just so many more men than women out there, particularly among young college grads.
Yeah. So John, going back to the perspective of these young single adult leadership, I think that the mistake that's made there is they make this assumption or create the stigma that, these individuals in their wards are marrying later because they're millennials, they're lazy. And so therefore it causes these leaders to create, classes or, a focus around how do we get these kids out dating? Cause that's the problem. When in reality, it sounds like from your research, the real problem is it's more of a faith crisis than a dating crisis of how they'd be better served if they said, how do we keep the men more faithful rather than how do we get them dating? Right.
Yeah. But I like to say, this is not a cultural problem. It's not a religious problem. It's a demographic problem. And if we had a group of vegans who lived in a closed community and only dated and married other vegans, and suddenly you had a 60-40 ratio of vegan women to vegan men, the exact same thing would be happening. This has nothing to do with beliefs or values or anything like that. A lot of these behavioral patterns are essentially hardwired into the human brain. And a lot, you know, there's a, if you read the book, if you read Datanomics, you'll see there's a lot of science in the book. And the consensus of psychology professors and others who studied sex ratios is that a lot of these behavioral patterns are essentially evolutionary adaptations, because you see similar kinds of behavior in other animal species when one sex or the other is in oversupply.
Once we realize it's a demographic problem, what are we supposed to do with that? Because there's many leaders that are out there trying to fix this problem. Maybe they just have no business trying to fix it when it's just the demographics, and do we just wait for that to shift, or is there a solution for this?
Well, if you're looking for a Mormon specific solution,
give us doctrine, John.
Yeah, no, this isn't doctrine. This gets back to something that I think Jeff mentioned earlier. I think one of you, maybe it was Jeff, who said that you referenced kind of the pariah status of non-RMs. I mean, I think moving away from that would be helpful. Having blogs about whether it's okay to date a non-RM is probably not good for the psyche of those guys, right?
Right.
and if the goal is to keep those guys in the church, you know, denying them leadership positions, right? Maybe this is less of an issue now, but certainly kind of viewing their status as having some kind of a taboo attached to it probably is not going to encourage them to to stay in the church. But more broadly, I do believe that this is one of these issues that just shining a light on it is likely to lead to improvements. I mean, like I said earlier, a lot of the science on sex ratios is an outgrowth of animal research. And you know, like scientists will take a nominally monogamous species, you know, be they voles or fish or something like that, and mess around with the sex ratio in a controlled population and see what happens. And, you know, what typically happens is that when the males are scarce, the males are more likely to abandon their mates. But the difference here is that fish do not have a conscience, or at least I don't think they have a conscience. And, you know, and they don't have morals and consciences the way human beings do. And there's actually a lot of behavior that could be hardwired that we've kind of grown out of, you know, over many, many years. And I kind of feel like that could happen here. If we knew that if everybody understood that the hookup culture and other behavioral patterns were linked to lopsided sex ratios, I kind of feel like that would lead to discussions that would change the culture.
One thing, you do mention the gender imbalance in Utah, but I think you argue that it's not as bad for Mormons outside of Utah. And do you feel that's really essentially because the Mormon men who don't go on missions don't feel quite as ostracized outside of Utah, where there's not a cultural hegemony, for example? Is that
that's what came out of my reporting. Am I wrong in that assumption?
No, it's much better living outside of Utah as a Mormon, as Kurt cannot attest. But I will tell you.
I've seen many examples of, you know, females who've left Utah and have better, higher rates of dating and marrying outside of Utah as opposed to inside of Utah.
Yeah, my journalist friend, the woman I mentioned, who I first called after reading the Trinity College study, I think she had a bunch of friends who had moved to San Diego and I think had better dating prospects there than they had in Utah.
Oh, no. The singles wards in San Diego were terrible.
Oh, all right.
That's a whole other episode. We need to get into that.
Jeff
maybe
is biased,
they just got lucky or something.
No. Jeff is biased.
All the kids live at home. It's the worst. You don't want to go there.
When I convert to LDS, I'll make sure I do not go to San Diego.
Attaboy. Also, you're married, so that would be bad. San Diego's a lovely city. I mean, my wife's from there. It's delightful.
It is lovely. You know, if you like surfing, particularly.
One thing I am curious about is a lot of your sources, when you go through this chapter, a lot of interesting people and thinkers from a wide variety of walks of life, some Mormons, some ex-Mormons, some doing different things. Did you try to get any word from official church leaders or anybody representing that end? Because I did feel like, unless I'm mistaken, that there didn't seem to be any sort of a comment from either church leaders or like church apologists or anybody along those lines. And I'm not saying that anything is negative.
I did have a quote from a BYU professor, David Dollahite, LDS leader Richard Scott was quoted in the chapter as well.
Oh, I must have missed the Scott quote.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen Reinhardt, who was a formerly single LDS member. I mean, I'm pretty sure he told me he was a lay leader in the church. And I know he's very active in Republican politics in the States as well.
We don't need to get into that terrible mess. But, because that is funny. Cause, yeah, we have lay leadership, but I just didn't know if you'd tried to reach out to, like, Salt Lake HQ, like the public affairs department, or any of the other bodies of the church leadership.
I put many calls into BYU trying to get various officials of BYU to talk to me. And part of my interest in BYU is that in the book, if you read the book, you'll see that I kind of use college campuses as case studies because they tend to be kind of self-contained dating pools. The students tend to date other students. So you can really see how the sex ratios play out. And I struck out with BYU. I could not get, for the most part, I could not get school leaders or most professors to talk to me.
That's not surprising. Sorry to hear that, though. That's not surprising.
For your benefit, Jeff, I actually have the Elder Scott's quote here, which...
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's a good example of how, I think, generally how young single adult ward leadership approach this is, it says LDS leader Richard Scott was quoted, "If you are a young man of appropriate age and are not married, don't waste time in idle pursuits. Go on with life and focus on getting married. Don't just coast through this period of life." And I think, so from what I'm understanding, that's a good example of somebody who is misunderstanding that they're trying to solve the problem by motivation when it's simply a demographics problem.
I mean, I understand. I mean, if I were a parent of one of these boys, that's probably what I would be telling them.
So they're not wrong in doing that. But
to be clear, listeners, Kurt just questioned an apostle.
No. But I'm just trying to get that point across, is that I'm not saying you're foolish in making those statements or encouraging, but they're maybe underestimating the problem that they're facing. It's a much larger problem.
They can't just be overcome by that. Not to be overly glib or to minimize what he's saying, but if you're blaming millennials for this, is the argument that there's something about being born between 1985 and 1999 that causes you to behave differently? I mean, I assume that's not the argument. So the next question is, okay, what's changed? It can't just be, you know, something in the water for kids who were born in that time frame, right?
You know, you mentioned that the only time that the scale flips as far as the ratio at BYU is the freshman class is 62% female, which is probably due to the mission age change, right? All the freshman boys have ventured off across the world to preach the good word. So is it safe to say that your best chance for a female getting married is during that freshman year, and they should maybe be less, they shouldn't be avoiding marriage if their long-term goal is to get married?
Well, I will say, when I was looking at the BYU gender ratio data, I got confused because the school's overall sex ratio or gender ratio was more balanced, but the freshman classes tended to be more imbalanced, closer to 60-40, and I didn't understand exactly what was going on. I mean, and yes, I'm sure the mission has something to do with it, but from talking to students and former students, I do have a sense that what happens is students who get married freshman, sophomore year, and then the dropout rate for the girls is higher than it is for the boys. So while the gender ratio might be more balanced for the upperclassmen, a lot of those guys aren't actually available. Is that fair?
I would say it's likely true. I mean, I don't know from experience firsthand, but I could see that being the case.
I guess my bigger picture, you know, if you're asking me to give advice to those women, and this is not unique to Mormon dating. This is all dating, you know, for college graduates or for educated people. I mean, I do not believe the college degree makes you a better wife or a better husband. And I kind of feel like the entire dating world would be saner and more balanced if college grads were less unwilling to date non-college grads. But the trend over the past 30, 40 years has been the opposite. It's been towards what sociologists call assortative mating, which is basically a fancy way of saying that educated people only want to date and marry other educated people. So this is the problem, because in the college world, you have too many women, and in the non-college world, you have too many men. And I kind of feel like it's inevitable that some of those non-college men will eventually end up with the college women.
One thing, if you ever go back and revisit any of this research, because of the age change in missionaries, it might be also be very interesting to look at the data for sophomores, because they changed the male age from 19 to 18, but they changed the female age from 21 to 19. And that's where there's actually been a much higher percentage of women going on missions compared to men because of that. So that would also be fun to look at just at some point, to see how that, what the gender ratios are amongst that age group at some point. I don't know. Popped in my head, because I can't help but wonder what that's like too now, with more of the girls taking off when they're 19 compared to before. Before, a lot of women didn't go on missions because they had to be 21, so they'd be about ready to finish college and say, do I want to do this? Not really.
This is tongue in cheek, but the other way you could fix this problem is by creating a new taboo against non-RM women. And
I like it.
We're finally getting solutions, John.
But John, that taboo kept me single for too long. Honestly, I think the funny thing is, when you look at all this research about Mormon men, and I feel like men, even in your book, it says, you know, they often get pickier as they get older. I think that's true in general. But I think I was pickier through my 20s, and I really had this idea in my head, like, this is how it has to be. And I think as I matured, I started to realize that, you know, there are different people with divergent interests, and you can still have relationships with them. And like, my wife today is an amazing person, and we have different interests, and she is not the person I, you know, got off my mission when I was 22 and said, this is how it's going to be. But I did like the research that you see a lot of these guys who are in their later 30s becoming really rigid and locked into their ways. And I imagine that's not unique to Mormonism.
It is definitely
either.
Not. No, I mean, no. One of my dating observations is that the people who get married in their 20s, they have like 5 or 6 things on their checklist. But like, when they get to their late 30s, they have like 20 things that they have to have. And, you know, I think maybe they've been holding out for so long that it becomes harder to compromise.
It does. And I think we also become very entrenched in our, just who we are and our views. And, you know, I think when people do get married very young, they kind of grow together through a lot of formative years instead of being more, you know, when we're more individualistic, the older we get, the harder it is to find commonalities, I guess.
I think that is a smart observation. I think you're right.
You drew some observations in the book about the plastic surgery culture. And this is, I'm way too close to problem to realize that, you know, once I do pay attention, every third or fourth billboard in Salt Lake is a plastic surgeon office. And I guess I assume that was the case everywhere. But there is definitely a culture of plastic surgery. And you sort of draw the conclusion that that is because of this lopsided demographic.
There is so much external pressure on, in any community where women are in oversupply, and in this case we're talking about the LDS community in Utah, in any such community there's going to be tremendous pressure on women to appear marriageable. And I think that that's what you see. This has nothing to do with faith or beliefs. This has to do with demographics and with the pressure that women face. I mean, if they're in a, you know, if there are 3 of them for every 2, you know, eligible men, and actually the numbers are worse for the older singles, it doesn't shock me that they're going to do what they can to, you know, to appear more marriageable and to appear more attractive. Whether this is investments in cosmetics and clothing and shoes, or whether this is Botox or plastic surgery, you know, I think this is just a byproduct of the external pressure on women to appear attractive.
This is very interesting to me, because just from my observations, I don't have any actual data, I've always felt that in Utah, it was more women who were already married, or what I always saw a lot of was like recent divorcees in their 30s. Because in the book, you talk a lot about, you know, single people trying to woo one another. So I thought it was very interesting to look at. I think Kurt's in the same boat. I always felt like, no, I see all the plastic surgery in Utah is women in Utah County who are already married. Kurt, am I off base there at the local?
No. I mean, I guess I, certainly people who get plastic surgery don't tend to be young. You know, like older people get plastic surgery, not 20-year-olds. So that is generally true. but I did interview plastic surgeons in Utah who told me they had, you know, college age girls coming in for Botox. So yes, I would say a majority of the surgeries are of the plastic surgery is done, you know, is purchased by older people or people in their 30s, 40s, 50s and older. And that's true everywhere, but I do think there's more pressure on single women in Utah to maintain their looks.
So John, in the final chapter of your book, you sort of propose some solutions that people can maybe take into consideration. Not that you've cracked the code or figured it out, but looking at the data, some possible options to do. And maybe let's just talk about those real quickly and see what we can learn from them. The first one is, well, I don't know if you said this directly in your book, but stop assuming that it's laziness in millennials or this millennial culture that's causing people not to marry.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, spend some time in San Jose or in Silicon Valley. Like, the guys there are workaholics. You know, they're not happy, lazy couch potatoes. They work very hard, and dating is hard for them. So one of the ways they try to stand out is by earning as much money as possible and by driving fancy cars and that kind of stuff. So, you know, if I don't think this is a byproduct of when they were born, although I do believe, and I make this point in the book, that whichever gender is in the majority does tend to be more industrious. So I think that's why this kind of stereotype of the happy couch potato, you know, college grad guy exists. And that's why if you go to cities like LA or Chicago or New York or Washington, like, so many of the go-getters are women.
As far as your solutions go, you mentioned making gender ratios a consideration when choosing a college. And this is sort of difficult for Mormons because I think most Mormons default to BYU because they're more concerned about what religion they are before considering
right, that's a, right. It's a loaded statement, Kurt. Most Mormons. Okay.
Well, what I'm saying is I think most – okay, I'll use not use the word most, no, but you know what I'm saying is that there's this
many,
culture in the church many people have an experience – at BYU, or at least include that on their list of applications.
Yeah, so that bit of advice is, you know, may not work for Mormons, and it's not, you know, while that chapter is not intended to be religion specific in the advice. So, but more generally, the schools, the colleges that are 50-50, or some of the tech schools like Caltech or MIT or Georgia Tech, those schools that have more men than women tend to have much more monogamous dating cultures, and you see more examples of happy couples from college marrying after college.
And it's funny because we're like kind of, you know, aiming for that as Mormons to have happy monogamous couples even in college. It's actually funny talking about this. My podcast co-host on This Week in Mormons actually wrote an article about why we should get rid of church-funded schools at one point, but basically arguing that, hey, maybe we'd all be better off if we were in our own local areas, and if you were able, you know, if you got away from the BYU mentality. I'm not advocating that necessarily, but it is, it's food for thought, though.
All right. Well, I have a solution for BYU. You ready?
Okay.
Yes. They should beef up their engineering program.
Oh.
attract more men.
But then how do we get dentists, John? Mormons are all about becoming dentists. If we're not dentists, we're nothing.
Is this like, Rudolph and who's the character of Rudolph who wants to become a dentist? Is that really a lot of?
It's kind of a running joke in Mormonism that a lot of guys try to become dentists. Yeah.
Yep. You leave Utah to go to dental school, and you come back and try and compete.
And then you buy your boat. It's great.
I did not know that.
So. Oh yeah, lots of dentists.
You've learned a lot, dentist Nick Moe. It's been a great night for John.
Okay.
So John, any other as far as the solutions in the books? I think they're great solutions and options, at least some takeaways, but any stand up more than others that seem to be working?
Well, I mean, my big one is to the college educated women should expand their dating pool to include lesser educated men. And again, I do not believe that a college degree makes you a better wife or a better husband. My prediction in the book is that we're going to see more of what I like to call mixed collar marriages going forward. And I kind of believe that if we all become more open-minded about dating, that some of these problems will solve themselves. And the only other one I would mention is, and this is for women, I guess, and maybe this is not an issue in the Mormon world, but at least in the in cities like New York and Washington, I interviewed lots of educated women who had a certain kind of life plan. And that was basically their intention was to focus on grad school or career in their 20s. And then when they hit 30, then they'll get serious about dating and finding a husband and starting a family and that kind of thing. And that's fine on paper, but the dating math works against that strategy. And it's I call it the musical chairs phenomenon. I assume you guys at some point when you were kids played musical chairs?
Absolutely.
Okay. So as you may recall, in the first round of musical chairs, you kind of have to be adult not to get a chair, right? You have to be like chasing butterflies or something. But in the last round of musical chairs, when there's two players and one chair, you have a 50% chance of losing the game. So in other words, the longer you stay in the game, the greater your chances are of losing. And this is kind of what happens to college-educated women. So if you start out, I'm just going to use simple round numbers here. You start out with a dating pool that has 40 women and 30 men, which is essentially what young college grads are facing these days. It starts out as a 1.3 to 1 ratio of women to men. But once half of the women, once 20 of those 40 women get married to 20 of the men, the ratio among the remaining singles becomes 20 to 10 or 2 to 1. And once five more of those women marry five more of those men, it becomes the single population becomes 15 women and 5 men or 3 to 1. So what happens is the longer women hold out, the worse the math gets for them.
That's really interesting. And then at the end, it gets down to what, 11 to 1 if the remaining four get married.
Exactly. I think this is why. When you, at least for me, and I bet this you see this in Utah as well, there are so many spectacular women who have everything going for them who are still single in their 30s, and they have moms and dads and married friends who assume that they're just terrible at dating, right? They must be doing something wrong, like, you know, they must not use deodorant or something. But it's not that they're terrible at dating; it's that the math is really bad when you're still single in your 30s.
I want to make sure John gets the chance to let everyone know where they can find his book or any of his other
John,
materials.
Where should we send people to check out?
Well, you can buy Datanomics at hopefully most bookstores, certainly online at either Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com and other online booksellers. You can also visit my website, which is Datanomics.com, also johnberger.com, johnberger.com. And there's information about the book and how to buy the book there as well.
Well, that's pretty good. I mean, as far as like talking to people goes, I was satisfied with it.
John's great. A smart guy. He knows his demographics, that's for sure.
Yeah. Do you have any? I want to study relationships now. That's what I need to do.
So what were your big takeaways? What'd you learn? What are you going to change? When you see that your single friend next, what are you going to tell him?
I'm going to tell him to get more active in the church. That's clearly the problem.
Yes. Got to stay active. And we got to get rid of these stigmas, right? As far as RMs and you got to marry an RM. You got to marry an educated guy that has a degree or has a solid life course, right? Obviously, hopefully has some.
Well, that was very interesting there at the end, the whole the mixed collar marriages. And I wonder how that's going to work in our faith, where we push education so hard that I think we get to the point that we look at any blue collar jobs and say, well, you know, I don't know about that. You're supposed to be out there, you know, getting that degree in some useless liberal arts thing from BYU that you'll turn into nothing later on. But that is a thing in the church. We value education so much that I think sometimes we forget that that could mean taking an apprenticeship or trade school or pursuing a perfectly noteworthy career as a craftsman or woman of some kind where you're paid well and you actually get excellent benefits and you have a perfectly great life and you can provide for a family and all those things. But too often I think thumb our nose at that.
Yeah,
and it's unfortunate.
I think that was my biggest takeaway, especially for, you know, if there's any YSA leaders listening, is the best thing to do is just sort of try and get rid of these stigmas. And, you know, the one being that, you know, that you always marry an RM, that you always marry someone who's educated, or and obviously not everybody's saying always. And I think there's a lot of articles online that are showing that there's a shift happening here. But I even think there's an additional stigma as far as if men have had issues with pornography, that sort of people write them off the list as well. But these are stigmas that, you know, it's great if you want to search for this perfect spouse, but you need to take into account that the demographics are off. And therefore, if you have these hard set characteristics of a spouse, it's just going to take a lot longer or may not happen at all. And hopefully you're okay with that.
Absolutely. And like John said at the end as well, that the longer you wait, the ratios get worse and worse.
The musical chairs.
And worse. That was an interesting analogy.
Yeah. It's not going to get better.
Sure. No, I enjoyed this. It was nice of him to take the time to talk to us. I enjoy seeing, seeing these things through the lens of a non-Mormon, his understanding of everything we're doing here. There's some good stuff to learn. Also, by the way, if you are a bishop in a singles ward or in a single stake, I also want you to ask yourself why, and just why, and why singles stakes exist, because YSA stakes should not exist. But that's a whole piece I'm going to write at This Week in Mormons at some point, because I'm convinced YSA stakes are just totally they're just wrong on every level. That could be a whole book. I'll spare you all here now.
And you're going to write it, huh?
I want to. Did you know, but basically all of the YSA stakes in the church are across the Intermountain Corridor, except there's one in D.C.
And oh, really?
We've seen, they organized one in D.C. late last year. And I have, it's before you had a lot of singles and they held stake callings. There were guys in the high council. There were people helping out with youth conference. They were involved in the stake, even though they were singles. But now it's like, nope, we have shunted you off. You are a lesser people. It is separate but equal or some murky thing like that. We don't need you as part of the regular church. Have your stake. It's one thing to have a singles ward. Have your little stake. Live your little lives. Don't bother us married folk. You bad people.
Tell us how you really feel about it, Jeff.
I've got feelings. I have got feelings. Major, major feelings.
Nice.
By the way, one thing I kind of wanted to, I wanted to take John to task for a little bit, but I didn't, was in his article, he talks about Duck Beach.
Yes. The famous, infamous Duck Beach.
And if you're not familiar with Duck Beach, my fellow Mormons, it's in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and Duck Beach, in quotes, refers to the huge stretch of land from Duck Beach all the way down to like Nag's Head, Corolla, wherever. The whole area along the Outer Banks there. Memorial Day weekend, Mormons from far and wide. It used to be D.C. Mormons and New York Mormons, and now it's just Mormons. People fly in from California for some dumb reason. And they go to Duck Beach, and you meet there. There was that documentary a few years ago, which was terrible. And, you know, it's so bad, I think now they borrow like the gymnasium at one of the local high schools so they can have sacrament meeting. It's this whole thing. But John made it out to seem that it is this land of debauchery and sin and everyone's sleeping around and getting drunk. Now, I'm not saying that there is not violations of the law of chastity at Duck Beach. I don't know. I've never been myself and I haven't observed, but I know a lot of people who go and they just have a perfectly pleasant time in the Outer Banks. And yeah, you might like make out with somebody or even get a relationship. Either way.
It's not John, what he painted it to be.
I felt it was a little harsh on Duck. You know, just a little harsher than I wanted it to be. That's all. It just seemed a little bit out of sorts. But all in all,
you're being harsh on singles stakes and he's being harsh on Duck Beach. You know, it's just what goes around.
I'm in a bad mood, Kurt, because we're re-recording this end of the show.
And, and it's 10 o'clock. Totally it's 10 my fault.
And it's 10 o'clock on the East Coast.
It is late there. All I'm right, like, Jeff.
You did this to me.
I apologize.
I'm all good with it. Anyway, get the book, folks. You can find it, of course, I think on both of our websites, on leadinglds.org and at thisweekinmormons.com. We'll link up to it. And it's worth a read. I think it's a pretty easy read, and there are a lot of interesting points about how demographics are affecting dating. Like, don't move to New York. If you're a single girl, you think great. You love watching How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and Hitch. You think that's the life you need. Don't do it. You're not going to be happy. Nope. You'll be very sad.
All right, Jeff.
So I'm going to say you could. Well, yeah. So, guys, you can send Kurt an email at kurt@leadinglds.org. Visit him at leadinglds.org.
And you can send Jeff an email at Jeff with a G at thisweekinmormons.com. And subscribe to his podcast. It's weekly. Sometimes he's on it. Sometimes he's not.
Now you never know who the hosts are going to be at this point. Last week we had, or recently, we had Greg Anderson talked all about his experience with censorship in film as that it relates to
That was oddly interesting. I listened to every minute of it.
He used to work at the Varsity Theater at BYU, and he talked about how they physically splice films to get rid of profanity and such, and how even back then it upset people. And this is, of course, with VidAngel today and all of that. But I digress. Anyway, it's been a pleasure, Kurt. Thank you very much for this great time we've spent together.
Well, and my message to you, Jeff, is remember, be a leader and not a calling.
That is, usually I say be well, be holy, and be happy. Yours is better. We're going to use yours. All right. I like it. So thanks, everybody.
See ya.
Happy week. Happy week.
This week in Mormons. This week in Mormons. This week in Mormons. This week in Mormons. The original Mormon News Podcast. This week in Mormons. Oh, the original Mormon News Podcast.